This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I am Gaius, John Batchelor. I welcome Germanicus, Michael Vlahos. We're in Londinium, 91 AD. Winter is ebbing. Spring is in the air. We're looking forward to, well, the snowdrops are up, but we want the daffodils to proceed. This is Rome, first century, empire, very secure, surrounded by retired centurions and their wonderful families, shopping and then going on home to the home fires. We'll go to the theater later. Right now, we're speculating about the 21st century because the Americans, inheritors of our achievement here in the first century, most of it anyway, not the attitude, but the mechanisms, the Americans are struggling with Ukraine war. A very good evening to you, Germanicus. I tell a story from the American Civil War. It is 1864, Washington. A man named Baker is head of the Secret Service. The Secret Service is guaranteed to be part of the apparatus that denies habeas corpus and pretty much abducts people when they're regarded as enemies of the state, Confederate spies. It also worries about security in Washington. It will be what tracks down John Wilkes Booth and shoots him in a barn, the Secret Service. But right now, the Secret Service is an office in Washington. And in walks a young Irish woman, weeping and gnashing and yelling, I must see Colonel Baker. I must talk to him. Why? She says that in New York, where she's come down from New York, her 11-year-old son was in the front yard and was kidnapped by the recruiters for the Union Army, taken to the fort where he was immediately put into chains with other men who were being kidnapped and sent to Virginia. And she doesn't know where he is. She doesn't know how to find him. Baker must help her. Why was he kidnapped? Because there were bounty men who were paid X number of dollars for every head they brought in to the recruiters sent to Virginia. They were marched immediately to the front lines around Petersburg and Richmond, and there they perished or lived. Good luck. This is a product of the draft riots of 63. The draft riots were because the draft, the wheel was in action today, and people wouldn't put up with it because they knew the rich men of town could buy their way out. That was 1863, 1864. You tell me there's a story in Ukraine that reminds both of us of the chains of the men sent to the front. What do you know, Germanicus?
One of the reasons that even as late as 1864, that Jefferson Davis and the South thought they might still win by an election that would overthrow Mr. Lincoln and put Mr. McClellan into the presidency was that there was this terrible malaise in the North, that the war was going nowhere and Grant was chewing up, along with Sherman, tens of thousands of men. And there was enormous resistance, as you describe, even though much of the people being targeted were American immigrants from Ireland, mostly, who had no real standing as American citizens. But the fact is, the draft riots of 1863 and the resistance against this impressment of young men into service was a sign that all was not well in the North, and the North was in a weak position. But of course, the North had the twin victories at Atlanta and then Mobile Bay with Farragut that turned things around and enabled Lincoln to win re-election. But remember, these riots, this resistance to impressment and conscription was coming from a party, you know, the state at war that was actually winning, that was going to win, that could not help but win. Now look at Ukraine in contrast. Ukraine is flat on its back. It's lost a million irrecoverable casualties, an entire generation of men, and the impressment that so resembles what you just described in the North in 1863 and 64 is the order of the day in Ukraine. And people are resisting everywhere in Ukraine. Mothers, daughters, the entirety of society is dead set against conscription because, as you say, once those young men or older men, often older men, mostly older men in Ukraine are conscripted, it's a death sentence. For example, today during the winter, I just heard from a Ukrainian officer talking about their situation. There is so much pneumonia, there's so much angina among Ukrainian soldiers on the battlefront who are older men, for the most part, in their 40s or 50s. And it's a death sentence. And so the entirety of Ukrainian society is mobilizing not to fight Russia, but to fight its own government. And it is a situation that cannot last very much longer. And the fact is, you can only squeeze so much blood out of a stone. There is very little left in terms of manpower reserves in Ukraine. This is not the kind of rich field of manpower that the North could draw upon in 1863 and 64. This is a country that's been wrung out. It is at the end of its reserves, and increasingly its people are united against their own government and are turning against it. They feel betrayed by their government. The war is lost. The front is beginning to collapse in a kind of uninterrupted series of one defeat after another, one outpost, one village, one place, and it's all across the length of the front. The Russian offensive is across the entirety of the line of contact now, so that Ukraine, with its precious few reserves, doesn't know where to go to stop one offensive action or another. And as a result, overstretched, outnumbered, totally outgunned, Ukraine is verging on collapse, and yet the measures it's taking to try and somehow scrounge up new, fresh bodies for the front is only accelerating the domestic collapse.
The headlines in London. Zelensky makes duplicates after counteroffensive plans of last year were leaked to Moscow. And tensions grow as 160 tons of Ukrainian grain sabotaged in Poland. And Moldovan separatists to ask Putin to annex their region. And in occupied Ukraine, the best way to survive is to stay silent. I could go on. We're looking at a narrative that's been developed that Ukraine is the valiant resistance and the Russians are wickedness, undermining everybody's understanding of freedom. And the reason the counteroffensive didn't work is because there were traitors. And the reason the next one will work is because they're F-16s or long-range attackums. What we're looking at, Michael, is hope is a plan, to be generous. Hope is a plan. Hope is not a plan. What the Ukrainians need is a negotiation. Do you hear it, Germanicus, anywhere?
Zelensky is indissolubly tied to his paymasters in the West, and he has no freedom of action. And therefore, his only approach, which is very reminiscent of a certain German Führer in 1944 to early 45, he can only keep pushing, and it's all beginning to fall apart. And the truth is that he is creating what amounts to a narrative very similar to the old German stab in the back narrative that emerged out of the debacle of the First World War for Germany. And that isn't going to work. And right now, we're seeing a situation where The West is stringing out Ukraine. I think the U.S. administration wants to keep Ukraine afloat through the election so that it doesn't bring the Biden administration crashing down in November. But that's going to be a hard haul for the U.S. executive branch to pull off, because the way things are unraveling now, as we've talked about, and as I have suggested week after week, is that the time of decision is now, and the moment, the hinge moment, is approaching in the spring to early summer. There is no way in which Ukraine can survive for very much longer. And the problem for the West, for NATO and the United States, is having created a narrative of inevitable Ukrainian victory. It cannot let go of that narrative, no matter how false it has always been, no matter how insupportable it is on the basis of evidence. Propaganda in the West has created a bodyguard of lies that has sustained this entire sense of Western expectation of inevitable and eventual Ukrainian victory. And once you've created that hydrogen-filled balloon of lies, when it gets popped and bursts into flame, there is no alternative approach. There's no path ahead. And I don't really understand now what the U.S. can do. If we look, for example, at the contretemps going on between Moldova and Transnistria, this is quite clearly an attempt by Mr. Putin to preempt any kind of NATO involvement in Ukraine by creating a potential threat to Moldova. In other words, Russia has been outmaneuvering the West at every step here. And the West, meaning NATO and the United States, has no viable alternative now, no path ahead in which Ukraine can stabilize the situation. U.S. commentators have been trumpeting for months that, oh, well, maybe the offensive failed, or as they would put it, it didn't achieve all of its objectives. But nonetheless, we can wait for next year and try again. And after all, the front is stalemated.
Let's go to NATO, Germanicus, because NATO is the next item that is going to come under pressure. I think we can agree to that. Germanicus is Michael Vlahos. We're in Londinium. It's coming spring. The full snow moon is behind us. We're ahead of us are the daffodils. We're speculating about what comes next for not just the Ukraine, but NATO itself, born in a treaty of 47, armed during the Korean War. And then, this is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.